This is Audible.
The Little Black Book of Workout Motivation, written by Michael Matthews, narrated by Michael Matthews. Praise for the Little Black Book. Matthews has hit it out of the ballpark with this Little Black Book. This is not your typical rah-rah self-help book full of tired cliches. It's a unique, meticulously researched, and compelling combination of storytelling, science, and practical tools and takeaways. Ben Greenfield, CEO of Kion and New York Times bestselling author of Beyond Training, Mastering Endurance, Health, and Life. This is a good, helpful, important book that establishes Mike as the Jordan Peterson of fitness. Any person who wants to train more effectively will benefit from reading it between sets and will never give a copy to the guys he wants to beat. Mark Ripito, author of Starting Strength, Basic Barbell Training, and Practical Programming for Strength Training. Matthews is a master of the mental side of fitness, so you'll finish this book fired up to get to work, and more importantly, with the practical tools you need to start your journey successfully. Alex Hutchinson, author of the New York Times bestseller Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. The word goal should be a verb, because a goal without action is just a dream. The Little Black Book of Workout Motivation provides all the tools you need to turn your goals into reality and to never, ever feel stuck again. Jeff Hayden, Inc. contributing editor and author of The Motivation Myth, How High Achievers Really Set Themselves Up to Win. This book will challenge you. It will make you think. It will force you to go outside your comfort zone. It will help you build much more than motivation, but an inner drive to succeed so you can weather any storm. Mark Perry, CSCS, CPT, founder and CEO of Built Lean. Mike has already taught us how to be bigger, leaner, and stronger, and it works. Now he teaches us how to be better in all areas of life. A concise, indispensable guide to fitness and effectiveness. Strauss Zelnick, America's fittest CEO and author of Becoming Ageless, The Four Secrets to Looking and Feeling Younger Than Ever. I love Mike's writing. Backed by a shit ton of research, crystal clear, and always actionable. Noah Kagan, co-founder of Sumo.com and AppSumo.com. In the charlatan-packed world of the fitness industry, Mike Matthews is a breath of fresh air. This book will inspire you and inform you with quality applicable information that isn't biased. If you want to improve your physique and your life, do yourself a favor and read The Little Black Book. Sal DiStefano, co-host of top-ranked fitness and health podcast, Mind Pump. Mike Matthews delivers another gem. The Little Black Book is chock full of unbiased, evidence-based knowledge that you should not live without. A must-read. Adam Schaefer, co-host of top-ranked fitness and health podcast, Mind Pump. Dedication. To everyone who reads my crap, some of which I'm proud of and some of which, well, you know, let's just leave it at crap. Seriously, though, I love you guys and gals and hope you find this book helpful. Free bonus material, guides, tools, and more. Thanks so much for downloading The Little Black Book of Workout Motivation. I hope you find it insightful, inspiring, and entertaining, and I hope it helps you reach your health and fitness goals faster. I want to make sure that you get as much value from this book as possible, so I've put together a number of additional free resources to help you, including a savable, shareable, printable reference guide with all of the book's key takeaways, exercises, action items, and checklists, a list of my favorite tools for getting and staying motivated and on track, inside and outside of the gym, 3 bonus chapters on the beauty and power of difficulty, how to engineer your environment so you need less motivation, and how to use gratitude to feel less stressed and depressed, reduce the risk of chronic disease, sleep better, and more. My most recommended books for building a better body and life, 3 interviews with thought leaders Stephen Guise, James Clear, and Mark Murphy on the topics of habit formation, goal setting and accomplishment, environment design, and more. To get instant access to all of that, plus an additional surprise gift, go here now. www.workoutmotivationbook.com/bonus. Table of contents. Praise for the Little Black Book. Dedication. Free bonus material, guides, tools, and more. Table of contents. Who is Mike Matthews and why should I care? The reinvention of Jennifer. How to use this book. Section 1. Cultivating the right mindset. Chapter 1. The little big things about building a better you. Chapter 2. The great art of sacrifice. Chapter 3. The trouble with waiting for perfect. Section 2. Setting the goals. Chapter 4. The greatest common denominator of greatness. Chapter 5. The wrong way and right way to set goals. Chapter 6. How to not suck at achieving your goals. Section 3. Doing the work. Chapter 7. You can fight resistance now or hate yourself later. Chapter 8. Can you carry a message to Garcia? Chapter 9. Excuses or progress. Choose one. Chapter 10. Shut up and train. Section 4. Staying on top. Chapter 11. So, you're having a shitty workout. Chapter 12. The curse of complaining. Chapter 13. The positivity paradox. Chapter 14. Beware the self-made myth. Chapter 15. Farewell for now. Chapter 16. Would you do me a favor? Chapter 17. Free bonus material, videos, tools, and more. Other books by Michael Matthews. Bibliography. References. Who is Mike Matthews and why should I care? Moderation is a fatal thing. Nothing succeeds like excess. Oscar Wilde. I'm Mike, and I believe that every person can achieve the body of their dreams. My mission is to give everyone that opportunity by providing time-proven, evidence-based advice on how to build muscle, lose fat, and get and stay healthy. I've been training for more than a decade now. In that time, I've read thousands of pages of scientific literature and tried just about every type of workout program, diet regimen, and supplement you can imagine. At this point, I can confidently say that while I don't know everything, I know what works and what doesn't. Like most guys who get into weightlifting, I had no clue what I was doing when I started out. I turned to fitness magazines for help, which had me spending a couple hours in the gym every day and wasting hundreds of dollars on pills and powders each month. This went on for years, and I jumped from diet to diet, workout program to workout program, and supplement to supplement, only to make mediocre progress and eventually get stuck in a rut. I then turned to personal trainers for guidance, but they just had me do more of the same. After spending many thousands of dollars with them, I still hadn't gained any muscle or strength to speak of, and still had no idea what to do with my diet and nutrition to reach my goals. I liked working out too much to quit, but I wasn't happy with my body and didn't know what I was doing wrong. I didn't look bad by any means, but it wasn't exactly what you'd expect from 1,500 plus hours of working out with no extended breaks. I finally decided that something had to change, and I knew that I needed to start with learning the actual physiology of muscle growth and fat loss. So I threw the magazines away, fired the trainers, got off the internet forums, and searched out the work of top strength and bodybuilding coaches, talked to scores of natural bodybuilders, and started reading scientific papers. Several months later, a clear picture was beginning to emerge. The real science of getting into incredible shape is very simple, much simpler than the fitness industry wants us to believe. It flies in the face of a lot of the crap we read in most books and magazines and see on YouTube and in the gym. For example, you don't need supplements to build a great physique. You don't need to constantly change up your workout routine to confuse your muscles. You don't need to eat clean to get and stay lean. You don't need to stop eating carbs and sugars to lose weight. You don't need to eat small meals every few hours to boost your metabolism. You don't need to grind out hours and hours of boring cardio every week to shed ugly belly fat and get a shredded six-pack. As a result of what I had learned, I completely changed my approach to eating and exercising, and my body responded in ways I couldn't believe. My strength skyrocketed. My muscles started growing again. My energy levels went through the roof. And here's the kicker. I was spending less time in the gym and eating foods I actually liked. It shouldn't have taken as long to get here as it did, but hey, better late than never, right? Along the way, my friends and family noticed how my body was changing and began asking for advice. I became their coach. I took hard gainers and put 30 pounds on them in a year. Took people who were absolutely baffled as to why they couldn't lose weight and stripped piles of fat off them and added muscle to their frames as well. And took people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s who believed their hormones and metabolisms were beyond repair and helped them get into the best shape of their lives. A couple years later, my clients, I never asked them for money, I just had them come train with me, started urging me to write a book. I dismissed the idea at first, but began to warm up to it. What if I'd had such a book when I started training, I thought. It would have saved me who knows how much time, money, and frustration, and I would have built the body of my dreams a lot faster. I also enjoyed helping people with what I had learned, and if I were to write a book, and it became popular, what if I could help thousands or even hundreds of thousands of people? That gave me a wild hair, and so I wrote Bigger, Leaner, Stronger and published it in January 2012. It sold maybe 20 copies in the first month, but within a couple months, sales were growing, and I began receiving emails from readers with high praise. I was floored. I started making notes on how I could improve the book based on feedback and outlined ideas for several other books that I could write. Fast forward to today, and I've now published a number of books, including a diet and exercise book for women, Thinner, Leaner, Stronger, and a flexible dieting cookbook, The Shredded Chef. Altogether, my books have sold over a million copies, and my work has been featured in a number of publications like Men's Health, Muscle and Strength, Elle, Esquire, and more. More importantly, every day I get scores of emails and social media messages from readers who are thankful for my work and blown away by the results they're seeing. They're just as shocked as I was years ago when I first discovered just how straightforward and enjoyable getting fit and healthy can really be. This is why I continue to write books and articles, record podcasts and YouTube videos, and generally do everything I can to be as helpful as I can to as many people as I can. It's motivating to see the impact I'm having on people's lives, and I'm incredibly inspired by the dedication and determination of so many of my readers and followers. You guys and gals rock. I also have bigger ambitions that I want to realize. First, I want to help a million people get fit and healthy. Help a million people just has a sexy ring to it, don't you think? It's a big goal, but I think I can do it. This goes beyond merely making people look hotter, too. I want to make a dent in the alarming downward trends we're seeing here in the West, in particular in people's overall physical and mental health and performance. And I think helping people get strong and fit is a great way to do that. Second, I want to lead the fight against mainstream health and fitness pseudoscience and BS. Unfortunately, this space is full of misinformation, disinformation, idiots, liars, and hucksters, and I want to do something about it. I'd like to become known as the go-to guy for practical, easy-to-understand advice grounded in real science and results. Third, I want to help reform the sports supplements industry. The pill and powder pushers rely on all types of scams to foist their junk products on unwitting consumers. They use fancy-sounding but worthless ingredients. They cut their products with junk fillers like flour and unnecessary amino acids. They use tiny, ineffective doses of otherwise good ingredients, pixie dusting, and hide it with the notorious proprietary blend. And they rely on fake science, overhyped marketing claims, and steroid-fueled meatheads to convince people they have the secret sauce. I hope you enjoy this book, and I hope it helps you reach your health and fitness goals faster. Mike Matthews, Vienna, Virginia, April 6, 2018. The Reinvention of Jennifer. When a great ship is in harbor and moored, it is safe. That is not what great ships are built for. Dr. Clarissa Estes. I set goals all the time, but I just can't make myself do all the things I need to do. Jennifer has to force the sentence out, shaking her head. She's ashamed with more than the words. She's ashamed with herself. Many people wouldn't understand why. She's 32 years old, attractive, and living well by most standards. She has a good job, she gets stuff done, and she has close friends who admire her. Some even say they wish they were her. Yet, here she is, fighting back tears because, at bottom, she's afraid. Not of failure, humiliation, or hardship, but of remaining stuck in a state of quiet, mediocre desperation. Of never quite discovering what she's truly capable of. Why do you think that is, I ask. She looks away for a moment. We're on a pier on a windswept beach in Florida, and white caps are rushing toward throngs of laughing children at the shore, crashing and fizzing around their skittering feet. I don't know, maybe I'm just too lazy, or maybe I just don't really care enough. I interrupt her. It's normal to feel like that, but you're wrong, and I can prove it. 3 months later, Jennifer and I had a very different discussion. It was a celebration. She had melted nearly 20 pounds of fat off her body, gained a considerable amount of muscle in the right places, and realized that she did have the power to transform her body. Her newfound gumption was rippling out into other areas of her life as well. For the first time in a long time, she felt unstuck. How did I help her do this? And how might I be able to help you do the same? This book is the answer. In it, I'm going to share with you exactly what I shared with Jennifer, and I hope that it can help you in the same way it helped her. This book is for people who want to be better than they are right now. People who have a vision for their bodies and lives, and who are driven to break free of artificial limitations, realize their unique talents, and fulfill their true potentialities. It's for people who hate feeling like they're moving in slow motion, who don't want to surrender to the deadening effects of exhaustion and inertia, and who want to develop the physical, emotional, and spiritual strength and energy needed to look and live vigorously. It's for people who are driven to heal what's unhealthy, fix what's broken, and improve what's lacking, and who believe that no matter the circumstances, something can always be done about it. It's for people who want to feel in control of their destinies and who want to reach their graves with stories worth telling. That said, this book isn't for everyone. It's not for people who are happy coasting on cozy goals and pleasures and who are contented with merely buying and consuming things that others create. It's not for people who want to languish in a fool's paradise and avoid the ground truth about positive change. Although ultimately rewarding, the process is often hard, draining, boring, and even depressing. It's not even necessarily for people who are unmotivated, because in my experience, this is very difficult to change. Instead, this book is for people who have a burning desire to be, do, and have more, and who could use some help with the how. As a best-selling author and coach, I've worked with thousands of smart, capable, hardworking people like Jennifer who have struggled to make simple changes in their lives. They want to stop doing harmful things like overspending or overeating, or want to start or keep doing positive things like exercising or educating themselves. While they generally know what they have to do, life just keeps finding a way to thwart their efforts. Sometimes it flashes shiny objects to distract. Sometimes it offers ill-fated shortcuts to discourage. And sometimes it crosses tracks to derail. And in too many cases, life wins. It knocks too many people down too many times, who then brand themselves failures and stop trying to get up. You probably know what I'm talking about. We've all been there. And we're all wrong. What we've done or failed to do doesn't forever determine who we are or will be. In fact, I believe that we have no idea what we can really do. We may never find out either. There may always be another level. But striving to reach the top is the most rewarding adventure life has to offer. I wrote this book to help you in that quest to seize the experience of being alive. This is a journey that many thousands have already taken and that is open to all. It requires no great talent, intelligence, or blessings, only the will to discover the path and walk it. To help you do this, this book is going to focus less on particular methods than on time-proven principles, because blind adherence to processes without an understanding of the underlying rules results in rigid, maladaptive behaviors and attitudes. It's easy to mistakenly believe that because someone before us succeeded by doing A, B, and C, we can do the same and experience the same results. This type of thinking is seductive because it appeals to the parts of us that are timid and lazy. But it also conveniently ignores the fact that no two products of nature are ever exactly the same. Circumstances never repeat themselves exactly. On the other hand, by learning to think in a principled way and exploring the reasoning behind those principles, we can successfully choose, discard, and even invent methods accordingly. This book isn't going to be a clinical discussion of the science of motivation. Much of what you're going to learn is based on decades of scientific research, but both of us know that books like that don't work. People do. And what makes people work are ideas worth working for and a clear understanding of what to do and how to do it. Intellectualizing isn't enough. We must reach the level of conviction before we can truly internalize and embody new ideals and behaviors. That's why I want you to test this stuff out and even challenge it as you move through the book. You won't need any new skills. You already know how to focus, write things down, make decisions, and take action. And you'll probably find that many of the things you've already been doing instinctively and intuitively are right. In this book, I will expose many of the prevailing myths about motivation, including why goal setting, positive thinking, and playing to your natural inclinations and disinclinations aren't enough to win in a world full of honeypots, deadfalls, and dead ends. For at least the last couple of decades, many brilliant people have been working tirelessly not to advance our general knowledge, judgment, or capabilities, but to convince us to buy more things we don't need, consume more poisonous foods and vacuous entertainment, and conform our thoughts and beliefs to a cultural hive mind that worships whatever feels right. And so it's no surprise that we have a dysfunctional normal where most people are comfortably numb. They've resigned themselves to what they believe they can and can't do and change, and have accepted the rules and restrictions dinned into them since childhood. According to various surveys and studies, they're on average 23 pounds overweight, they do just 3 hours of real work and watch 5 hours of TV per day, and they're over $130,000 in debt with less than $1,000 in savings. They sit, they eat, they watch, and they die. Somewhere along the way, though, they'll wonder what happened and whom to blame for their misfortunes. It's not your fault, the psychosocial tastemakers will coo. You're not responsible for your condition. You're a victim of your circumstances. Yes, something in them will say, that feels good. That must be right. And then the power dive begins. To master motivation, then, you have to get radically honest with yourself and the reality you face and go far beyond what you find familiar and comfortable, because as unnatural as modern living is, it isn't the real enemy. What's the real enemy? The part of us that clings to the default and status quo and recoils from anything it deems dangerous, difficult, or different. This is the only thing that can stop us from transforming who we are into who we want to be. This is the part of us that says there are things we just can't do, boundaries we can't overstep, and rules we can't break. And we buy into it because it gives us a false sense of security. Even if we're completely dissatisfied with our everyday existence, at least we know the lay of the land and what to expect. This is the part of us that says we should just do whatever makes us happy. If something is instinctive and spontaneous, then it must be right. This is also the part of us that rejects golden opportunities to advance and evolve because they seem strange or dubious. And so we shy away because we've been conditioned to fear the unknown. We submit to these genetic and social instructions because they're the well-worn paths of least resistance. Even if we're adrift in the tides of unknowable forces, at least we aren't alone. Even if we're wearing blinders, at least they're hiding things we don't want to see. By the end of this book, you will never again wonder what it takes to stay motivated to build the body and life of your dreams. You will be inspired by compelling ideas and stories, and you will be empowered with a set of reliable, science-based principles, strategies, and habits that have been shown to work with a broad range of personalities to produce sustainable, long-term results. This isn't to say that you will become superhuman or even that you need to. Ironically, most of the wildly successful people I've known don't see themselves as all that special. They experience disappointments, decision traps, and uncertainty just like everyone else. They struggle with procrastination, habit making and breaking, and second guessing, and often more than others because they're so dedicated to pushing their limits. They've just learned to deal with these more unsavory aspects of life differently than most, and you can too. This is going to feel unnatural and awkward at first because, well, it is. You're going to bumble and stumble. You're going to slip and fall. And sometimes you're even going to want to give up. All of that is totally normal. Welcome to the club. This is the process. This is how you transform. I've been there myself, and so has every other person I've ever known who has escaped the strike zone of a normal life that makes no difference to anyone and changes nothing. Armed with the information you're going to learn in the pages ahead, you're going to start living life with more energy, enthusiasm, and nerve. You're going to develop a new paradigm for interacting with yourself and your environment. And if you really take these lessons to heart, you might just enter a transformative period of your life and discover that you're capable of far more than you ever thought possible. So here's what I want you to do right now. Listen to the next two chapters today. Yes, today. I know you're busy and you have lots to do, but jump in and commit, and in just 15 minutes or so, your transformation will have officially begun. Excellence can be yours. Your best body and life ever await. Just keep listening. How to use this book. If you have everything under control, you're not moving fast enough. Mario Andretti. Many people struggle to realize their ambitions because they spend too much time thinking and too little time doing and looking. They formulate perfectly reasonable decisions to do perfectly wonderful things based on perfectly accurate observations, and then start the process of self-sabotage, thinking. I'm pretty busy right now. Maybe this isn't the right time. I'm probably too young, old, uneducated, uncreative, uncredentialed, pessimistic, etc. What if this doesn't work? What if I fail? What will people think? It's not long before those who survive this initial bombardment of weaponized head trash and actually get started have to endure another wave of assault. This doesn't feel right. I don't think I'm ready for this. This isn't very fun. The ranks are thinned again, leaving fewer people still in the fray. Before long, another barrage is unleashed. Do I really care about this? I'm exhausted. Maybe I'm not good enough after all. More hopes and dreams are blown into smithereens as the cannons are reloaded, and those still standing wonder when the offensive will relent. For many people, it never does, but that doesn't necessarily stop them. Abraham Lincoln suffered from spells of severe depression throughout his entire adult life. For many years, John D. Rockefeller fretted endlessly about his company and didn't get a single night of solid sleep. All the fortune that I have made has not served to compensate for the anxiety of that period, he later said. George Eliot, whose opus Middlemarch has been called the greatest novel in the English language, was so self-conscious of her writing that she used a male pseudonym and dreaded every submission to her publisher. I wish I could say that we will have it better, that we won't have to weather our own storms, but it's simply not true. We will have to jump into the trenches like everyone else if we want to get anywhere, and the farther we want to go, the deeper we will have to venture into the labyrinth. That doesn't mean we have to become a casualty, though. If we can do just one brutally simple thing well, then no amount of psychological and emotional trauma can put us down. If we can truly embrace this one little thing, then we can even learn to tune out the treacherous voices in our heads and inoculate ourselves against their poison. This little thing is action. By staying in motion, the roots of doubt and despair can't take hold and ensnare us. By doing things, we can't be stopped by thinking things. That doesn't mean we shouldn't plan, deliberate, and reflect, of course. We must be able to assess reality and deal with it as it is, not as we wish it were. It means that we shouldn't feed the trolls that live in the shadowy recesses of our minds. That's why this book is going to ask you to do more than just read and think. Although it has motivation in its title, it's meant to do more than make you feel something, because that's never enough. As the old Chinese proverb goes, tell me, I'll forget. Show me, I'll remember. Involve me, I'll understand. As you'll see, every chapter is going to end with a do this now section that is going to have you put what you just learned through its paces. This way, you can quickly see what will help you and what won't. All you need to do these exercises is some paper or a notebook and a pen. You can also find them, along with chapter summaries, in the free bonus material available at www.workoutmotivationbook.com/bonus. If I've done my job well and you follow my instructions, then you will be closer to the person you want to be and the life you want to live by the time you finish this book. How much closer will depend on many things, not the least of which will be how much action you're willing to take. So let's begin, shall we? Section 1. Cultivating the Right Mindset. Chapter 1. The Little Big Things About Building a Better You. We who cut mere stones must always be envisioning cathedrals. Quarry Workers' Creed. People didn't get why Dan was doing it. Why was he pouring so much time and energy into working out? Why was it so important to him? Was it narcissism? Had he fallen in love with his reflection? Maybe it was insecurity. Was he wrestling with an inferiority complex? Or was it something darker, like self-loathing? Was he unable to accept himself the way he was? They were all missing the point. Dan didn't train to feel vainglorious, paper over shortcomings, or punish himself. He did it because it gave him more than a better body. It gave him a better life. When Dan first reached out to me, he was in a bad way. He was 37 years old, 30-something pounds overweight, and frustrated and confused. Name a diet, and he had tried it. He had run the gauntlet of popular exercise programs without much to show for it. You don't want to know how much money he had wasted on clueless trainers. Dan was ready to resign himself to the apparent reality that it was just too late. For one reason or another, hormones, metabolism, stress, voodoo hexes, it appeared that his opportunity to get into great shape had come and gone without even a whisper. He was wrong, of course. He just needed the right diet and exercise principles and systems. At first, he was skeptical of my advice. He thought it was too simple and that there was no way you could control your body's fat-burning and muscle-building machinery that easily. Give me 4 weeks, I said, and if you're not absolutely floored by the results, I'll pay you $1,000. A month later, He was in disbelief. For the first time in his adult life, he was seeing real, measurable changes in how he looked and felt, and he was doing it without starving himself, following a restrictive diet, or eating foods he didn't like. He could do this for the rest of his life, he realized. That was several years ago, and Dan hasn't stopped. In fact, he's now in better shape than his college days. 20-year-old Dan wishes he had 40-year-old Dan's body. He also realized that his workouts build more than muscle. They build character. They teach us how to have the courage to commit to goals. They teach us how to create purpose and meaning. They teach us how to stop making excuses and finding reasons to fail. They teach us how to stop being a victim and take responsibility for ourselves. They teach us how to stop chasing magic bullets and quick fixes and embrace the process. They teach us how to get gritty and push through pain and adversity. They teach us how to value long-term satisfaction over immediate gratification. At bottom, working out teaches us a very powerful lesson. If we have the power to change our bodies, we have the power to change our lives. That's why we train. We train because fitness is one of those special things in life that you can't buy, steal, or fake. There aren't any rewards for complaining or failing, and fitness doesn't care about your opinions or feelings. You have to give something to get something. You can't slide by on bullshit. It's called working out, after all, and for good reason. You either do the work and transform your body, or you don't. This is a valuable lesson to learn because it's a metaphor for something bigger. No matter what you're facing in life, you have two choices. You can put in the work or get put in your place. Nature smiles at the economic, political, and social institutions we erect to try to change this. Let's not forget that not so long ago, our forebears had to chase, fight, and kill just to survive. They expected hardship. They were willing to face the worst. They embraced the fact that the universe, in all its apparent tranquility, is a carefully balanced chaos of forces that we barely understand. We, on the other hand, have it easy. And that makes it easy to go soft, lose perspective, and be lulled into idleness. Working out is something of an inoculation against this. It's a tribute to the primacy of effort. A reminder that unless we're willing to work for them, secrets will never work. Reading books or blogs may supply pieces to the puzzle, but we still have to roll up our sleeves and figure out how they all fit together. All that can point us to the work, but then we have to do it. If you find this discouraging, you're looking at it wrong. Groping for shortcuts is discouraging. Stumbling around in the dark, anxiously turning over rocks in search of arcana is discouraging. Waiting for lightning to strike your bottle is discouraging. On the other hand, donning the yoke can be incredibly encouraging. Yes, it's bulky and uncomfortable, and yes, it demands toil and sweat, but it also promises a return on your efforts. You may not always get the prize you want, but you never leave empty-handed. This makes the gym a lot more than a place to move, grunt, and sweat. It's a microcosm where we can make contact with the deeper parts of ourselves, our convictions, fears, habits, and anxieties. It's an arena where we can confront these opponents head-on and prove that we have what it takes to vanquish them. It's a setting where we can test the stories we tell ourselves. It calls on us to demonstrate how we respond to the greater struggles of life, adversity, pain, insecurity, stress, weakness, and disadvantage. And in some ways, who we really are. In this way, the gym is a training and testing ground for the body, mind, and soul. The conflicts we learn to endure in the gym empower us in our daily lives as well. The concentration, discipline, and resilience carry over. The way to do anything is, at bottom, the way to do everything. The gym is also a source of learning because it calls on us to constantly attempt new things. It's a forum where questions are at least as important as answers. And it cultivates what scientists call a growth mindset by teaching us that our abilities can be developed through dedication and hard work, a worldview that's essential for great accomplishment. The gym is practical too, not idealistic. It's a laboratory open to any and all ideas and methodologies, and it gives clear, unqualified feedback. They either work or they don't. In short, the gym can be so much more than merely a place to work out. It can be a refuge from the chaos around us, a world of our own that we create to satisfy dreams and desires. The gym can also provide us with something missing from so many people's lives: principles, values, and standards to live by. In short, a game worth playing. Without a game worth playing, nothing else really matters. Life becomes a daisy chain of random events that happen to us accidentally rather than intentionally, without rhyme or reason, direction or meaning. It doesn't have to be like this, though. Fate has dealt us a hand, but we get to choose how we play it. This is one of the many reasons to love fitness. It has purpose, order, and significance. It's an outlet for integrity, intention, and excellence. It fosters community, commitment, and a clear focus on worthwhile results. The type of results that bespeak prized virtues like discipline, patience, work ethic, self-respect, and passion. The type that speak louder than words and posture. The fitness game goes deeper than that, too. It's a metagame, so to speak, because if you have what it takes to conquer your psychology and physiology, then you might just have what it takes to reach out into the world and conquer a whole lot more. In short, the better you get at the fitness game, the better prepared you'll be for every other game you might want to play. Whose story better exemplifies that than Arnold Schwarzenegger's? Born in Austria in 1947 to an alcoholic ex-Nazi who beat him as a child, forced him to do sit-ups to earn breakfast, and ridiculed his boyhood dreams of becoming a bodybuilder, Arnold's rise to fame and fortune was a masterclass in self-determination. As a kid, Arnie promised himself that he would leave Austria and make something more of his life, and he found inspiration in the most unlikely of places. A magazine article on the iconic bodybuilder turned movie star Reg Park. Arnold's imagination soared. He envisioned himself becoming the most muscular man in the world and then making blockbuster movies and million-dollar paydays. That's exactly what he would do, he told himself, and so he began training his body. His friends were amused. "Come on, you're dreaming," they would say. "Give it up." His father was harsher. He said that such fantasies were embarrassing and arranged for Arnold to be shipped off to the military at 18, where there would be no time or equipment for bodybuilding. Or so he thought. Arnold resolved to do whatever it would take to make his daydream a reality. So, after long grueling days of running, crawling, marching, shooting, and soldiering, when everyone else was literally collapsing from exhaustion, he worked out, sometimes for hours, using chairs, benches, bars, and whatever else was at hand. As usual, Arnold's peers lampooned his antics. They saw a useless fool trying to build castles in the sky, but Arnie wasn't fazed. He was determined to break through, no matter what it took. Reaching his goal of being a world champion became his singular focus in life. Arnold's first chance to make a splash in the bodybuilding scene came when he was invited to compete in the Junior Mr. Europe competition in Stuttgart, Germany. There was a problem, though. It would require that he abandon basic training and face severe consequences upon his return. Night after night, he turned it over in his mind. Was he really ready to go to jail to compete in a bodybuilding show? Was all this really just a crazy delusion? No, it wasn't, he decided. Reg Park did it, and he could do it too. When he closed his eyes at night, he saw himself standing on the stage, triumphant, just like his idol, and knew that he had to go. So he snuck out of the base, stowed away on a freight train, rode for 26 hours, borrowed another competitor's trunks, he didn't own any, shuffled onto stage and awkwardly presented his physique to the skeptical judges and crowd. And he won first place. This was a watershed moment. It gave Arnold something tangible to hang his hat on. It proved that maybe he wasn't so foolish after all. But there was a problem. He was also still enlisted in the Austrian army. Furthermore, after unsuccessfully trying to sneak back into his barracks, he was castigated by his superiors and thrown into solitary confinement. After cooling down, though, the officers wanted to know if it was true. Did Arnold actually win the show? Indeed he did, he explained, and it was all thanks to the rigors of their training, he added, playing up to his seniors. As men who valued discipline above all, they accepted the invitation to share in his victory and even began presenting Arnold as a model recruit. From here, Arnold continued to build, mold, and sculpt his body while completing his stint in the army. He then took the bodybuilding scene by storm, and in just a few short years, had not only mounted its highest pedestal, but helped transform the sport from an obscure, low-rent hobby into a glamorous celebration of the physical aesthetic. Becoming the best bodybuilder in the world was only the first phase of his plan, though. The next domain to conquer was the silver screen, so Arnie went west, only to be met with scorn. The awkward accent, the bulging muscles, the weird name, none of it worked, Hollywood gatekeepers said. Be realistic, they told him, it's not going anywhere. As usual, Arnold paid them no mind and got to work. He landed his first acting gig in 1970 to play, as fate would have it, Hercules in a low-budget comedy called Hercules in New York, and then burst into the limelight in the 1982 box office hit Conan the Barbarian. What followed includes now iconic films like Total Recall, Predator, Terminator, and Terminator 2, and to date, his films have grossed over $1 billion, making him one of the most successful action movie stars of all time. Arnold's run for the California governorship was more of the same. No way, no how, impossible, wins handily. Not bad for a starry-eyed Austrian kid nobody believed would or even should amount to anything. This story exemplifies why the gym can give us a lot more than muscle and strength. It can give us more life. Every day we show up and put in the work, it transforms more than our physiques. It transforms our very being. So, that was the Austrian Oak. What about you? What game do you most want to play? What do you value most? What are your strengths? Who do you most want to become? Don't sell yourself short when reflecting on these questions. Don't nod along with the reasons why you think you should downsize your dreams. Don't allow the reality of who you currently are snuff out glimmerings of who you could be. Don't skid through life ignoring the music that is inside you. Recommended reading: The Magic of Thinking Big by David Schwartz. Do this now. What's your why for fitness? Why is it a game worth playing? Why do you keep showing up? Reflect on those questions and write your answer down. Why does that matter? Why is it important to you? How does it benefit you? Reflect on those questions and write your answer down. Why do those things matter? What do they mean to you? What is special about them? Write your answer down. Continue this process of asking why until you've written something that clicks, that puts a sparkle in your eye and makes you say, yes, that is really why I do it. Write this down. In case you're curious, here's my personal take on this exercise. What's your why for fitness? Why is it worthwhile? Why do you keep showing up? To look and feel good and be healthy. Why does that matter? Why is it important to you? How does it benefit you? Life is just better when you're happy with what you see in the mirror, when you feel energetic and healthy, and when you don't have to worry about developing disease or dysfunction. Why does that matter? What does it mean to you? What's special about it? I want to do a lot of things well in life, personal growth, career, love, friends, etc., and taking good care of my body will make all of them easier to do. Neglecting my body, however, will make them much harder, if not impossible, to achieve. I also want to be a certain type of person. I want to embody the values and ideals I admire, like honesty, honor, diligence, resilience, and independence. As my body is literally the embodiment of my character, taking care of it is closely intertwined with this. Therefore, when I work out, I'm not just working toward a better-looking body, I'm working toward every single one of my goals and the person I really want to be. Chapter 2: The Great Art of Sacrifice. Don't sacrifice who you could be for who you are. Dr. Jordan B. Peterson. Many years ago, the legendary golfer Gary Player was hitting balls on the range while people looked on in awe. "Man, I'd give anything to be able to hit a golf ball like you," someone in the gallery called out. Gary walked over to the man and calmly replied, "No, you wouldn't." "Yes, I would. I'd give anything to hit like that." "No, you wouldn't," the Hall of Famer repeated. "You wouldn't be willing to do what it takes. You have to rise early in the morning and hit 500 balls until your hands bleed. Then you stop, tape your hands, and hit 500 more balls. The next morning, you're out there again, with hands so raw you can barely hold your club, but you do it all over again. If you do that through enough years of pain, then you can hit a ball like that." The man was dumbfounded. Not only was Gary right, he certainly wasn't going to do that. He couldn't believe the pro had to work that hard to make it. He assumed, as many people do, that such an elite performer had ascended to the top of his profession on a balmy updraft of inborn talent and divine providence. American culture is particularly enamored of this myth. We scorn workaholism and love stories of mysterious prodigies who accomplish great things with effortless grace. We thrill when Matt Damon's character in Good Will Hunting scoffs at mathematical proofs that have stumped the brightest minds at MIT. Do you know how easy this is for me? This is a fucking joke. We jeer when captains of industry ascribe their success to sweat, blood, and toil, and we dream of maybe one day stumbling into our own latent superpowers that will put us on the fast track to fame and fortune. As much as we might want to believe this tale, it's simply not true. While some people come better suited to certain activities than others, decades of research into human performance has made it abundantly clear that both innate talent, nature, and environmental factors, nurture, play backseat roles in the development of greatness. For example, a striking number of legendary artists lived and worked in Renaissance Florence in the 15th century, including Leonardo da Vinci, Raphael, Brunelleschi, Michelangelo, Verrocchio, Donatello, and others. Why? Genes alone can't explain this phenomenon, and neither can environmental considerations. How could so much good DNA accumulate in one place in just a couple of generations? And how were Florence's tumultuous political and economic landscapes conducive to the practice and development of high art? If the nature and nurture theory can't account for this remarkable flowering, what might have caused it? In Renaissance Florence, it was common for young boys to begin apprenticeships in craft guilds, where they would work under the close supervision of skilled artists. Michelangelo, for instance, began his apprenticeship at age 6, starting with stone cutting, followed by sketching and creating frescoes. Leonardo da Vinci didn't get his big break until he was 46 years old with the Last Supper. the genius present in his work wasn't inherited, it was forged through thousands of hours of deep, difficult work. How many people today marvel at Michelangelo's David or Leonardo's Mona Lisa and mutter that they'd give anything to be able to sculpt or paint like that? How many people burn for a new body, job, partner, or life and proclaim that they'd do anything to grab a hold of that brass ring? No, they wouldn't. They wouldn't hammer or paint until their hands or eyes bled and then hammer or paint some more. They wouldn't crawl out of bed every day into the cold darkness of dawn to train. They wouldn't burn the midnight oil to become the type of person who deserves the better job, partner, or life. Instead, they actively avoid whatever is difficult and uncomfortable, live according to their feelings and impulses, and decry life's challenges as unfair and people's criticisms as hurtful. They don't want processes and paradigms. They want shortcuts and hacks. They don't want to plant in the spring and tend in the summer to earn the harvest in the fall. They want to shirk and slack and reap bounties they didn't sow. In short, they lack the discipline to trade today's pleasure and gratification for tomorrow's security and satisfaction. And if they consider their future prospects at all, they're unrealistically optimistic in their forecasts, envisioning best-case scenarios and not most likely outcomes. We can sympathize with this plight, though, because, let's face it, discipline is hard, maybe one of the hardest skills to learn. All of us are, by nature, flawed and fickle creatures that aren't wired for scrupulous self-control, but for freewheeling novelty and stimulation. A powerful and primal part of us will blithely repeat what we want to hear instead of telling us how far we still have to go. How can we outmaneuver and overcome this deep-seated programming? We can start by evaluating our relationship with sacrifice, because while we may say that we want many things in life, if we're not willing to make the right sacrifices to get them, we're just pretending. Ingmar Bergman was a Swedish director and producer of over 60 films and documentaries and 170 plays and is widely considered one of the greatest and most influential movie makers of all time. "Do you know what movie making is?" Bergman asked in a 1964 interview. 8 hours of hard work each day to get 3 minutes of film. And during those 8 hours, there are maybe only 10 or 12 minutes, if you're lucky, of real creation. And maybe they don't come. Then you have to gear yourself for another 8 hours and pray you're going to get your good 10 minutes this time. For much of Pulitzer Prize winner Toni Morrison's writing career, she worked a day job as an editor at Random House, taught university literature courses, and raised 2 children as a single mother. "I am not able to write regularly," she told the Paris Review in 1993. "I have never been able to do that. Mostly because I always have had a 9-to-5 job. I had to write either in between those hours hurriedly or spend a lot of weekend and pre-dawn time." James Joyce estimated that he spent nearly 20,000 hours writing Ulysses. 20,000 hours. That's nearly 7 years working 8 hours per day, 7 days per week on one book. A book that would ultimately become one of the most acclaimed works of fiction ever created. Frédéric Chopin's innovative, nuanced, and technically challenging compositions have established him as one of the greatest composers and pianists of all time, but his creative process was far less harmonious than his masterpieces. Without foreseeing or seeking it, a melody or tune would come to his mind, and he would then lock himself up in a room for days and begin a desperate, heart-rending quest of trying to get what was in his head down on paper. He repeated bars hundreds of times, writing and rewriting everything. He once spent 6 weeks on a single page, only to finish with what he'd first produced. He wept, paced, broke pens, and struggled to find the motivation to get out of bed each day and persevere, and after finally completing a composition, often regretted that what was left wasn't as clearly defined as what he had originally imagined. While I'm no Bergman, Morrison, Joyce, or Chopin, I can relate to their struggles. I've worked 80-hour weeks for months on end. I've made mistakes that have cost staggering sums of money. I've weathered organizational and logistical storms that